Did the Vikings really wear horned helmets?
And why aren't the police called in every time human remains are discovered?
Answers to those questions and more in this episode of the Time Team Podcast.
Yes, welcome to the Time Team Podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. Now, this episode is all about answering the questions you've submitted on Patreon. We've had some great ones come through and I can't wait to get started on them. I'm also going to be bringing another object to the table in Helen's find, something of historical and archaeological significance that I hope you'll find interesting.
That is on the way very soon. Speaking, by the way, of Patreon supporters, the lucky few will be getting prepared to join us at Sutton Hoo in just a few weeks' time. Congratulations, by the way, if you were lucky enough to be chosen to help us on site. We cannot wait to see you. Do come up and have a chat to us. And we probably will see you too, because we're going to be hosting the podcast from Sutton Hoo every week during the dig, taking you to the heart of the action. So you'll get updates as they happen and you'll learn loads more about our work there. So not long to go to wait for that. Speaking of Sutton Hoo, Helen, before we get into the Patreon questions and all of that, there was some news a little while ago about Sutton Hoo and the Sutton Hoo helmet. Can you just sort of explain what all that was about? Because I kind of read it and I thought I need to talk to you about this. They've been doing some work in Denmark that has been shedding some light on the Sutton Hoo helmet. So can you just explain? Well, first of all, can you just talk about the Sutton Hoo helmet and set it in a bit of context? You know, what is it? What does it look like?
Yes, the Sutton Hoo helmet is the most extraordinary thing. It's not like any other Anglo-Saxon helmet. Well, when I say this, that's a ridiculous thing to say, really. It's not like any other Anglo-Saxon helmet, because you probably don't know of any other Anglo-Saxon helmets. There are only about four or five known. And the Sutton Hoo one is unusual in that it's got this kind of full face mask. When you look at it, it feels as if you're looking into the face of an Anglo-Saxon. It's often reproduced as an icon because it can be simplified very easily, because it's got these kind of D-shaped black eye holes that you would have been able to look out of, but when you look at an empty helmet, they're dark black, and it looks like a face wearing sunglasses. So it looks incredibly cool, and it makes a really good icon just for the past in general. So often if you need an icon to show history, like if you're in a quiz and you want an icon to show questions on science or questions on history, people will use the Sutton Hoo helmet icon as a symbol of just history in general. So it's become unbelievably famous. It's the one object that people might know of, a famous object from the past. It kind of outshines everything else, like the Alfred jewel or the Ringlemere cup or anything like that.
And they originally thought then that this helmet was from Sweden or had links to Sweden?
Well, the kind of helmet it is with a face, it's actually much more like a Roman helmet. These Roman parade or sporting helmets are kind of full face covers, and they're used in martial sports, if you see what I mean, kind of gladiatorial contests and that kind of thing. They're not really for fighting in, they're more for showing off in a sense. That doesn't really work in the Anglo-Saxon world, because you can't really imagine an Anglo-Saxon saying, oh, here I am showing off in my helmet. Now I see that there's a bit of something kicking off, I'll just go and put it in the cupboard and get out my real helmet. You know, the division between showing off and actual warfare that does occur in the modern era and in Roman times just doesn't happen in the Anglo-Saxon world. It's riddled with militarism from top to bottom, and you can't divide it off in that way. So it's got that Roman element, but when you look in detail, it's got all these little pictures all over it. The structure starts off, it's framed by a great big serpent that runs across, a snake that runs across the top of the head as a kind of crest. And that ends in the snake's head on the forehead between the eyes. That snake is made up of metal wires and so on. The snake's head then touches a bird. The wings make the eyebrows and the tail makes the moustache of the face. And in between that frame are all these little square panels that are made of tinned bronze, so tin produces a silvery colour, and they have pictures of warriors doing various things. Some of the scenes are warriors on horses, and some of the scenes are warriors with spears that look like they're dancing, and they're wearing kind of dressing gowns. Dancing in your dressing gown is not possibly a terribly warlike thing to do, but the dressing gown is the last thing we have left of that kind of wrap over and belted garment that was also thought of as a warrior's coat. It was a practical coat to wear if you were a warrior either on foot or on horseback in the early medieval period. So this Scandinavian nature of it comes partly from it being a helmet, and then there are lots of helmets in pre-Viking Scandinavia, and partly from these pictures. One of the things that people want to know about the Sutton Hoo helmet is where these pictures came from. And they're found all over Northwestern Europe, with examples in Sweden and in Germany, and we've also got examples from the Staffordshire Horde now. But the holy grail, so to speak, of working out where these things in inverted commas come from is finding a die that can be used to make them. So these tinned bronze pictures are made from squashing foils of tin. They're very much like the aluminium foil that you get something like a mince pie in, or a Mr. Kipling's cake or something. And you can hammer them over a die. And a few of these dies have been found. There's a very famous early find from Sweden, which perhaps is one of the reasons why we tend to say it's come from Sweden, rather than the Swedish helmets have maybe come from England.
Right.
But it's not just Sweden that's produced these dies. And the news was that another one has been found in Denmark, but actually there are also at least two from Britain. I think there's one from Herefordshire, and I think there's one from Lincolnshire. And so the argument has been, look at this die we've just found in Denmark. This was used for making the kind of foils that are used on the Sutton Hoo helmet. So maybe it's Danish. But you could equally say, look at this die from Lincolnshire. This was used for making those kinds of foils. Maybe the Sutton Hoo helmet's from Lincolnshire. And arguing from one object, from a culture that's spread over northwestern Europe, you know, I'm not a fan of a Danish origin. And I wasn't terribly much a fan of a Swedish origin, because I think something that British people tend to do is you find some aspect of culture and you immediately go, where did it come from? As if we never invent anything. We're just passive recipients.
Maybe it came from here. Yeah.
Yes. And I had an amazing experience once talking to an Irish archaeologist. She's a filigree expert. She was telling me about filigree. And then she said, and where did this filigree on whatever wonderful Irish object it was come from? Maybe it came from Britain. And I thought, no, nothing comes from Britain. We always look to Italy or France or Sweden or somewhere that's in some way more sophisticated. But realising Irish people do the same but include Britain in their more sophisticated places made me realise that we've just got to calm down and take a breath and say some things were invented here. We don't necessarily know which ones and we can't always prove it. But I think the most likely place that the Sutton Hoo helmet came from is probably where it was found, which is England.
So interesting, isn't it? And I do wonder what more questions we may be left with about the origins of various items from Sutton Hoo as our work continues there when we return in just a few weeks' time. And don't forget, on this podcast, we are going to be there. We're going to be at the heart of all of the action because you'll be able to hear from Sutton Hoo every single week that we are there. Can't wait to bring that to you. Shall we get on with the questions? Because we've got a few questions here from people on Patreon to do. We've also got Helen's find coming up as well. Question number one comes from, well, it's from a couple actually. It's from Andrew and Marion, who ask this: how accurate is the old history book depiction of Vikings wearing horned helmets? It's the image you have in your mind whenever somebody says Vikings. You can picture great big long bushy beard, and they're probably holding some sort of axe, and they've got a big helmet with horns sticking out. But was that what they actually looked like?
Sadly, no. I don't quite know how we ended up with Vikings wearing horned helmets. I know that there have been a few books written on the subject of how the Vikings were used in 19th century art at the time of Wagner. I think Wagner's got a lot to answer for, and there were a lot of beautiful oil paintings produced around the same time which showed Vikings with horned or winged helmets. Now, the winged helmet, I think, has got something to do with the Greek gods, maybe Hermes, who had the winged sandals. Did he also have a winged helmet? I'm on slightly dodgy ground here. I'm better with the horned helmets because I'm pretty sure that there was a mix-up between Iron Age helmets, which do sometimes have these extraordinary kind of prongs, not exactly curved horns, but conical things sticking out of them, and Viking helmets. And if you look up the Waterloo helmet, that's an Iron Age helmet that I think is now in the British Museum, you'll see what this prototype is, and it's Iron Age, it's not Viking Age.
So will they have used horns for anything, the Vikings?
You said horn. There is a helmet which is made partly from horn as a material, and this is the Bentigrange helmet, which is one of those very few early Anglo-Saxon helmets. That was found in a barrow in Bentigrange in Derbyshire in the 19th century, and it's got a framework, a bit like the framework I was talking about on the Sutton Hoo helmet of the snake over the top of the head, and the framework of the bird on the mask. The Bentigrange helmet has an iron framework that covers the skull. I shouldn't really say skull, should I? That's what it is when you dig it up, but it was obviously the head when it was in use. And in between, in the little spaces between the iron framework, it was horn. And you think to yourself, well, that's ridiculous. That horn is a soft material that is not going to protect you in any way. We'll leave that aside for another day. The question, why is the Bentigrange helmet made of horn, is a big question that I don't think has ever been satisfactorily answered. But again, you can see that this could turn into a certain amount of misinformation. There's a horn helmet, but not a horned helmet.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Important distinction, because it affects,
yes,
what it might look like. Mm.
Yes, absolutely. And then they just look so great, don't they? The Viking horned and winged helmets.
They're iconic. Yeah. They're absolutely iconic.
Yes.
Unfortunately, it's an icon that did not exist.
I think that's the fairest way of putting it, yes.
All right. Great question. Thank you, Andrew. Thank you, Marion. Question number two comes from Terence Bone, which is an amazing name for somebody asking a question about archaeology, who says this: I've seen loads of episodes where you find whole skeletons. Surely you don't need to call in the police every time. And that's a good point, right? Because you are, as an archaeologist, unearthing skeletons very often. But you can't be kind of calling 999 and getting the police in every time, because you obviously know that, because you're surrounded by archaeological experts, you know that the thing that you found in the ground is not something that was there, you know, 2 or 3 years ago. You know it is something ancient. So you're not calling in the police, are you?
No. Normally, if you can predict that you're likely to find human remains, so if you're digging next to a church, or if you are digging in a churchyard, or you know that you're likely to find an Anglo-Saxon cemetery, like our work at Sutton Hoo, you get a licence to exhume from the Ministry of Justice. And that's exactly the same licence that the police have to get if they want to investigate, say, a suspicious death where the burial's already taken place. So that means that you're kind of in the clear, that you have notified all the necessary people, authorities. There will always be cases where you don't have a licence and you do run into human remains completely unexpected. Now, this is not a problem for most archaeologists, because you simply make an application for a licence. It takes a little while, maybe a week. It comes through and you carry on. Obviously, if you're on a three-day time team excavation and you find human remains, that can be really difficult, because you know, particularly if we do it across a weekend, you know you're not going to get a license in time. So there are people who have emergency contacts within the time team, production team, and we have been known to get a license within 24 hours. But that's just some very kind person at the Ministry of Justice going above and beyond to make sure that the archaeological work can happen. So that's the normal situation. If, say, you are just maybe doing some work in your garden and you come across something that you think may be human remains, then you do obviously have to phone the police because you don't know how those got into the ground. And the police will normally come out and have a look, and they may be able to tell if they're human or animal, and they may be able to tell if they're recent or not recent. But most of the time, they try to get an archaeologist to come out with them to help.
Oh, right. So have you ever had to go, you know, the hello, what's going on here? We need to get Ellen Geek involved.
No, sadly, I'm not an osteoarchaeologist, and that's who you really need. You need a Jackie, you need a Naomi, you need somebody like that who can say, that is a pig, or that is a dog. Especially these days, you know, people do bury their pets much more often in their back garden than they ever used to. So there are probably far more bones in our back gardens than there ever used to be. So you need somebody who knows about it to help the police, because the police, good though they are at recent stuff, they don't know very much about how sites form over hundreds of years. So if something's hundreds of years old, they will often need help from an archaeologist. So that's the reason that we don't call the police out every time. Number one, we've already got permission. And number two, they're more likely to call us than we are to call them.
I see. They've got you on speed dial and you've got the Ministry of Justice on speed dial. Yeah. I think I've worked out where the hierarchy is here. Great question, Terence. Very good indeed. Returning to the questions in just a moment. But first, it's time for Helen's Find. Now, this is the bit of the podcast where Helen brings an object, an ancient object, to our attention. And it could be, well, it could be anything, but it will almost certainly be fascinating. So what have you got this time then, Helen?
Well, I thought I'd show you something that I recorded a really long time ago, right back at the turn of the century, so 25 years ago. And I want to show you this one because we've been talking about Sutton Hoo a little bit this episode. And this is one of the first objects that I recorded that I thought might have a link to Sutton Hoo. And it ended up changing my thinking quite a lot. It's a terrible, terrible photograph because I am generally a pretty poor photographer, but I didn't actually have a decent camera at that point, so that's why you're looking at such an awful image. But if you look at the main record, you'll see that there's a beautiful drawing of it done by the very talented illustrator at Suffolk.
Okay, and by the way, I'm going to put these links, if you want to see what we're talking about here, I'm going to put the links in the description of this podcast, so you'll be able to have a look. One link is to the image that Helen's talking about, and the other one's to the illustration, so you'll be able to actually go and have a look at this. But it is... it's small, it's gold. I can see a little flecks of red on it as well.
Yep.
But as to what it might be, or even sort of describing its shape, I think I'm perhaps struggling with a little bit here.
Okay, it's conical. That's the first thing to notice. So it's got one narrow end and it's circular in cross-section. So if you cut it in half, it would be circular. And it flares towards the other end, and there's a hole all the way through it. So what it is, in fact, is a glass bead. It's half of a biconical glass bead. And those little red things in the gold cells are garnets. Now, you'll see on the photograph that between the rows of garnets, there's then a gold strip, and it looks like it's solid gold. But if you look really, really carefully, you can see that, in fact, what it is something called a lidded cell. So this area between the garnets is like a single cell, rather than lots and lots and lots of those little rectangular cells. It's a single cell that's had a gold lid soldered in place on top to make it look solid. And if you look at something like the Sutton Hoo shoulder clasps that have got amazing writhing animals picked out in garnet against a gold background, the gold background is all lidded cells. And it was thought for years and years and years that lidded cells were something that was only found at Sutton Hoo. They were a characteristic of the Sutton Hoo workshop or the Sutton Hoo jeweller. And when I first saw this, that was my view. I thought, well, I've read that this is a Sutton Hoo technique, so I got very excited and said this could come from the Sutton Hoo workshop. And particularly as I was working in Suffolk at the time, I thought, wow, we might be getting first glimpses of this material being found further afield, being used further afield than just Sutton Hoo. And then we began seeing more and more of this. And the final nail in the coffin of this being the Sutton Hoo workshop technique was the Staffordshire Hoard, which is absolutely full of lidded gold cells. So you've got lots and lots more of those interlaced animals picked out in garnet with lidded cells running all the way through the Staffordshire Hoard stuff, particularly on the decorated Saxe handle. That's one of the most famous finds from the Staffordshire Hoard. So I'm putting this in as a bit of nostalgia for me, because it was the one of the first things that I recorded in my job as a finds liaison officer that took me back mentally to Sutton Hoo. Mm-hmm. But it was also the start of something new, of realising that there's an awful lot of this jewellery out there. We don't know why. Why is there so much gold in circulation in the 7th century? Why is there so much available to be made into jewellery? Because if you remember our Time Team episode at Wynfarthing, that's also absolutely full of gold. The amount, I mean, we can't weigh the amount of gold used in the grave at Wynfarthing, because it's also bound up with more garnets, but there's a lot of gold in that grave. There's probably more gold in that grave than in any grave of the 6th century. And we don't know why or where it's coming from. The garnets, we do know where they're coming from, because you can use scientific techniques to analyse them. They're mostly coming from either Czechoslovakia, or some of them, but mostly from India and Sri Lanka. So that's enormously long trade networks.
Yeah.
And the great thing, the last great thing I'll tell you about this object, is that those garnets are cut on the round. They're shaped to follow this curving cylindrical conical shape of the bead. So the grinding and the polishing is being done at a higher level, perhaps, than some other on some other objects. It's a really lovely little thing, isn't it?
It is. It's really almost cute, I would say.
Yes.
You can go and have a look at that on the Portable Antiquities Scheme website. The link is in the description to this podcast. This is the Time Team Podcast. Martin Williams and Helen Geek here. Helen is answering your questions that you've submitted on Patreon. And this one comes in from Joanne. Hi, Joanne, who says, how do you find out about and subsequently evaluate whether you want to take on a dig at a particular site? And then whether you'll send an expedition crew or the full Time Team experience? Now, Joanne, you might, I think there's a sort of an element of the answer to this question you might already know about because you are a Patreon member, because on Patreon now, if you scroll down, you'll be able to see our what's called a site wrestle. And this is where, and you'll be able to see it if you go on there now, some of the key players in Time Team will come together all with an idea of where they want to go and dig and what they want to go and do. And they'll sort of thrash it out. So they'll sort of say, oh, well, this site's really important because I think we'll be able to discover this, 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 and this. And this is the archaeology and this is the story we'll be able to tell. And then someone else will come along and go, oh, well, that's quite good. But what about this site that I've been working on? And this is interesting because of this, 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 and this. And we will have this site wrestle. We'll wrestle it out, not physically, obviously, although I'm sure that would be very, very entertaining to watch.
It's bound to come one day.
It is, yeah. When we hit the sort of Saturday night primetime BBC One, that's when we're doing the proper site wrestle. No, but they'll sort of have this discussion about whether they want to go and investigate a particular site and the merits of going to one place over another. And you can actually see that in action if you're interested over on Patreon right now. So that's sort of part of the answer to the question, but it goes a bit deeper than that.
Well, it starts off, of course, with the archaeology and with whether we're going to have 3 days or whether we're going to have 2 days in the expedition crew. So the first question is always going to be, are we going to be able to do something with that archaeology in the time we've got available with the resources we've got? And sometimes you have to say no, like we would never have been able to do a 3-day excavation, for example, at Sutton Hoo, because it just needs more time than 3 days. However many people you've got, it needs slow work because we know that there's finds in the topsoil. We can't just strip the topsoil off with a digger. Whereas if you're in a ploughed field, where you are fairly sure that you've got something that's going to be just underneath the topsoil with nothing in the topsoil, you can scrape the topsoil off very quickly with a digger. That's just a very quick couple of examples. If you've got something like a ruined castle, where bits are actually sticking up out of the ground, you've already got something that you can work with. You can do the above ground archaeology, and you know that you've got below ground archaeology. You know exactly where it is. You can quickly access it without the risk of damaging it while only having 3 days. So it's appropriate for a 3-day evaluation. So that's just the basic archaeology stuff. Is the archaeology robust and simple enough to tackle in 3 days or in 2 days with expedition crew? The next thing, though, is the thing that we always have at the back of our minds is, what if we don't find anything? And there was only one site, I think, where we didn't find anything at all that was linked.
And it was one of Time Team's most popular episodes ever, I believe.
It's very popular with me, but I don't know whether it's popular with everybody. It was Warburton. And I'm afraid it was sparked by metal detecting. And it was a lot of metal detected finds that were thought to be Roman. Now, this was a long time ago, and it is notoriously easy to mix Roman metalwork up with Victorian metalwork. And by the time we had excluded everything that we knew wasn't Roman and then made a big pile of things that we didn't know were Roman or not, we ended up with something like 6 brooches and 5 coins. And we thought, oh, we are in with a problem here. Then the geophysics came back and had basically nothing apart from a big ditch. So we dug a section into the ditch and we didn't really find anything to date the ditch. And it was all very difficult. And I ended up filming, you know, after racking my brains as to what story you could tell without any really good solid archaeology. And I said something, I've never been able to bring myself to watch the final episode, so I don't know if it made the cut. But what I said was, fired up with inspiration suddenly, I said, you know, when you go into a cathedral, or in fact any parish church, any medieval church, and you are moved by the fact that people have been doing the same thing in this very space for 500 or 1,000 or 1,500 years. That simply being here and doing the same things as people have been doing so often for so long gives you a kind of, you can reach back across the centuries and feel like you're holding the hand of somebody 1,000 years ago. I said, well, we're really used to doing that in churches, but you know, this field, it's been a field for over 1,000 years. And all of the crew burst out laughing, and they said, you're surely not serious, a field.
We've discovered here in this field, a field.
Yes, agriculture has been going on here for thousands of years, and it's still going on. So that was difficult. So what we try to do then is we try to predict, if we're not going to find anything, can we tell a story? And that is much easier to do for the historic past, where we've got some records of individuals, of personalities, of people that we could tell their story, whether or not we find material remains. So that is why I think we often tend to do things that are slightly more recent, why we have to work harder for prehistory. And sometimes for prehistory, we tell the story of how it was discovered in the past. So the history of antiquarians and great heroes in the development of archaeology. So the story is the next thing. And then we have to work out if there are hotels nearby, if there's an expert in that particular thing that we can ask to come and comment on, if there's somewhere that we can put up the marquee, if there's a friendly landowner, if it's scheduled, are we likely to get scheduled monument consent from Historic England? Will the conservation costs be too high? And then finally, of course, we don't want to do all of our excavations in one part of the country. So if we haven't been to Wales for a long time, say, a site in Wales, even if it doesn't tick every other box, we'll say, well, Wales is an interesting place. We ought to go there. We haven't been there for ages. So we can prioritise that one, bump it up the list a bit. So there's loads and loads and loads of things that we have to build in. And anybody who comes to a site wrestle who can say things like, there's a really keen community, there's a really supportive landowner, there's a barn that we can have lunch in, there's a huge car park. All those things don't, they're nothing to do with the archaeology or the story, but they're little...
It's the practical...
Yeah, the practical
practicalities
things.
Of making a TV show and doing archaeology at the same time.
Yeah.
Lots to think about. Great question again, Joanne. Thank you very much. Final one then from Martin Packer on Patreon, who says, we know modern transport infrastructure has an impact on the growth and prosperity of communities. I wonder whether roads and tracts had the same impact on pre-Roman communities, such as hill forts, and how the advent of Roman roads affected the relative prosperity of communities. I suppose this is all about how quickly you can get from A to B and the benefits that that might bring to the communities that are along the route of a Roman road that might see all this passing trade or have the ability to get to the next town or the next city much quicker than they would have done previously.
Yeah, and talking about hill forts and so on reminds me of you going out with Stuart to the hill fort that he's been studying in Shropshire.
Bodbury Ring.
That's it, yes. And how our views of hill forts have been changing. In the early days, say the first half of the 20th century, maybe even up to the 1960s, hill forts were really thought of as defensive structures because defence was in our minds all the time because of the world wars that were being fought. And then in the 1960s, as that was kind of receding and people were thinking more about the individual and identity and status and hierarchy and so on, they began to be seen as places where you would perhaps be showing off. You know, you'd go up to the top of a high hill and you'd build an enormous thing and you'd light lots of fires and you'd have lots of smoke and you might do feasting and other elite semi-ritual activities up there. For both of those then, perhaps roads weren't so high on our priorities, looking at how hill forts and Iron Age trackways and Roman roads, how they integrated with each other, wasn't that high on our priorities. And in fact, I don't think transport has ever been very high on archaeologists' priorities. And I don't know why, because I find it absolutely fascinating how you physically got around to places is really important. And when you hear stories like St. Wilfrid, who's having an argument with the king in 7th century Northumbria, and the king annoys him, and so he says, well, I'm going to go and ask the Pope who's right. And he goes off to Rome. And he comes back and he says, the Pope says I'm right. And the king says, well, I'm the king and I don't see the Pope around here. And so you're not going to get your way anyway. St. Wilfrid goes back to Rome. Now, we imagined him kind of flouncing off, going to Rome, and then he pops up in Rome, you know, cut to the next scene in Rome. We don't think about how he got there.
No, and how long it would have taken that journey.
Yeah, and whether flouncing off... he'd have had to take some weeks to flounce off, I think, to do all his packing and organising. Yeah, so we don't think about it enough. And that's where these Patreon questions are so brilliant. So Martin Packer, you have made me think much more about roads and why we don't study them. But I think that one of the things that we've got to be cautious about is not using the modern world to interpret the past too much. If we kind of go from the modern world backwards and edit out the bits that we know we shouldn't be taking into account, the first thing I think I might think about is railways, because we know that railways massively affected places' prosperity and that they weren't put in very sensible places. So the classic example is always Portsmouth and Southampton. Portsmouth, the home of the Royal Navy, should have had a railway really early on, and if there was any centralised planning, the government would have built a railway to it. But they didn't. Because they were all built by the private sector, by bands of merchants getting together or people from the towns getting together and saying, we need a railway for trade. And Southampton got their act together much earlier and got a railway to Southampton, and Southampton boomed and Portsmouth didn't. But as we go further back, it's not really all so much about trade. It's not so much about movement making you rich. It's more about things like agricultural wealth making you rich, and the ease with which you get it out is not quite so important, because you get kings and lords who are moving around the country, coming and eating their rents, as they say. So if you're producing a large amount of something very valuable like cheese or or honey, your lord can come and eat that, and people can come and buy it, and you can perhaps get it out by river or pack horse. And rivers, I don't think we think enough about how useful rivers are. They don't need much maintenance, and you don't need to build them in the first place. So a town on a river is always going to do better. And this is very important for heavy, valuable things like salt, which you've got to get out. And it seems that river transport is normally used for salt. But, you know, this is just a series of random, unconnected thoughts, really. And I think I'll just finish by saying that we still have a problem in the Roman period with our roads and the study of them, because we think that the population of Britain in Roman times is about the same as it was, say, just before the Black Death, or in the 17th century before the Industrial Revolution gets going, probably about 4 million people. And the study of Roman roads has not kept pace with the increase in the population that we know about. So that if you look at Roman roads on the map, or you look at a book about Roman roads, it's still really about those main roads, the trunk roads, the ones that are marked on the Ordnance Survey map. What about all those little roads that went to smaller places? We perhaps aren't building in those so much. And are they done later? Are they right there from the beginning of the Roman period? And if so, do they have some link with Iron Age places? I don't know. And I don't know if that work's being done. I'd like to see more work done on roads. And I perhaps should read the stuff that I know has been done on medieval roads and how those are. How do you carve a new road out of somebody else's land? All of these questions are just so fascinating. And I can see that they could open up years of research, each one. But I've got to find out a bit more about that one.
Roman roads, Roman stairs. There's a lot of work still to be done, isn't there? I think
there
by the sounds
there
of it.
There is.
There absolutely is. Well, look, that is about all we have time for on this week's episode. If you've got a question for a future one, then do head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and comment on a post that you find there about one of the most recent podcasts. So maybe the one about Doggerland, for example. There's loads of extra stuff on Patreon, by the way, from Time Team, extended interviews from the podcast, behind the scenes footage, additional information. Well worth becoming a member for all of that and the knowledge, of course, that you're supporting archaeology around the world and here in the UK.
And join us next week when Martin spends time at one of the UK's most famous or infamous archaeological sites, Flag Fen. Mm. And he'll be getting a tour from the man who discovered it, Francis Pryor.
Yeah, and Francis has some pretty concerning news actually to bring you about that site as well, so make sure you're around for that.
Plus, we'll chat with one of the internet's most well-known word nerds, as he calls himself, Rob Watts, from the Etymology YouTube channel, Rob Words. And he's going to tell us how language can offer archaeologists clues about how people lived in the past.
It is going to be a great episode. Really hope you're able to listen. Hit follow now to make sure you never miss an episode. And we'll speak to you next time on the Time Team podcast.